podcast again. Let me tell you my the protocol for discussions. I don't know if I explained the one-hand, two-hand rule last time. Did I talk about this? So if you want to raise an issue, raise your hand, and I'll keep a list. If you want to jump into the discussion responding to what's just been said, you raise two hands. So two hands enables you to jump the queue, but the rules of the game are you can only do so if you're directly responding to what's just being talked about. If you have a point that you want to make or a theme you want to raise that isn't directly tied into what's right on the table, then you just get onto the list of people to raise issues. Okay, so that's one hand and two hand. Sometimes I relax it, too. If we're having a lively discussion and several people are just going back and forth, then just let it rip, you know, rather than have it be heavily moderated. But more generally, the one-hand and two-hand process is the way we'll do it, okay? So Dimitro had a one hand up at the very end of the talk, so...
I want to, in terms of these standards of living, do you mean kind of particular country like the United States, or do you think globally, or does it apply to the whole world? And in the first case, if it's only for particular countries, what class or which strata would be kind of the turning point on these kind of standards of living? And if it's taken global, then which country and which class again?
Right. So the moral claim, the value of equality, says in a just society, all persons should have equal access to the necessary material and social means to live a flourishing life. And all means all. It's an injustice if in the world some people do not have equal access to the material means to live a flourishing life. It's an injustice that people in Mexico do not have equal access to the material conditions to live a flourishing life as equal to those in the United States. Now, that doesn't necessarily imply that the solution to that problem is open borders, right? Because like in any proposed social change, you have to ask, given the context, if we were to simply eliminate borders and let people move wherever they want, in the world as it is now, would that improve conditions for people to live a flourishing life or make things worse? Well, that just depends upon what dynamics get set in motion by such a change. So if it's the case that social solidarity within countries is a key thing to allow for redistribution, and a mass influx of people who are culturally different, who don't understand the traditions and history, erode social solidarity, you could end up at a worse equilibrium with open borders than without it. So it's not, but all persons means all persons. Now, when I invoke the issue of material standards of living in the sustainability discussion, just to emphasize that access to the material conditions to live a flourishing life does not mean access to the maximum amount of material consumption possible, because maximum material consumption is not a necessary condition to live a flourishing life. These get to be very tricky matters if you really dig deeply in a fine-grained way. It's not simple, because cultural standards people acquire by the time they're an adult, certain kinds of reductions of material standards of living would be felt as real deprivation by people, even though if they had lived under the reduced standards of living from their childhood, they would flourish. That's because of the nature of human culture and human beings. A really interesting experiment, sort of thought experiment, is the following. In 1950 or 60 in the United States had by far the highest average standard of living in the world, right? By far. We were the envy of the world in 1960. If between 1960 and the present, all increases in productivity in the United States had gone to reducing the working week, but keep the standard of living the same, so the material standard of living would be the same now, the average material consumption of Americans, just speaking on averages now, there's the internal inequality issue. Let's just bracket that. If the average standard of living of a person was the same now in terms of how much stuff they consumed, the same as it was in 1960, the average work week would be about 15 hours a week. Now, if you ask somebody in 1960, who's at the median, the average person, which would you prefer, to continue working 40 to 50 hours a week and earn 3 or 4 times what you earn now, or work only 15 hours a week? You know, less than 2 days a week. The rest of the time is free time for you to do whatever you want. But stay in your 1,500 square foot house and, you know, have your Oldsmobile and whatever. Which would you choose? Well, if you ask people that question, overwhelmingly people want to work less at the same standard of living. Then they want to massively increase their standard of living, if they're at the kind of social average. But of course, it's gone the other way around. Okay, so that's because, and now if you ask them, would you prefer to work 15 hours a week at a third of your current income, or keep doing what you're doing now, they'd say keep doing what I do now. And that's because needs, one's sense of needs adapt to one's expectations. People's imagination about how it would be if they earned less than they do now, they're locked into a set of habits and comparisons with other people. You know, so these are all sort of tricky psychological and cultural matters. I don't know if that answers the... Maddie.
So earlier in the lecture, you were talking about envisioning viable alternatives. And I know you touched on that in the book too, but how do you go about deciding whether something is viable or not?
Right. Well, it's a big problem. The bigger the difference between the existing structure of things and the proposed alternative, the harder it is to firmly establish in a credible way viability. So the more speculative is the alternative relative to the present, the bigger the number of changes, the harder it is to provide convincing argument that it's viable. It's one of the reasons why in my work on real utopias, I focus mostly on what I call prefigurative alternatives. That is, alternatives in which there is some empirical representation in partial and incomplete ways in the world as it is. To take a kind of simple example, worker cooperatives, worker-owned firms, where the workers own and democratically manage their affairs collectively. Worker-owned cooperatives are a fundamental alternative to capitalist firms. It's a different way of organizing production. One can imagine an economy in which virtually all firms are worker-owned cooperatives. So one can speculatively imagine what could be called a cooperative market economy, where all the firms, or nearly all the firms, are democratically run and owned by their workers. And one can imagine various kinds of institutions that would make that possible and which would block the possibility of one firm buying another unless the workers in those other firms became full members of now a larger cooperative. So one could imagine that. We don't know how well that would work as a whole system. But we do know that worker cooperatives are viable. We can study them. There are a few places in the world where there are regional economies that have lots and lots of cooperatives. In the Basque region of Spain, 40% of the income is generated by worker cooperatives in that particular region. In Emilia-Romagna, in the middle band of Italy, very high density of worker cooperatives. So we can study the empirical cases which prefigure this broader. But there's always then a gap. How you fill that gap, how you argue for the viability of the bigger systemic expansion, the scaling up, the scaling out, the replication, that can be very tricky. And because it's tricky, in the scientific mode, one should be wary. You should realize that there are risks involved in being too sure of yourself, in believing that, yes, I know it works on a small scale, therefore it'll work on a big scale. It's why, therefore, one would ideally like to imagine processes of moving from here to there, where you can continually learn as you go and expand your capacity to understand and correct course as needed. But there are maybe historical moments where you basically have big bang opportunities that you can leap to a whole new system because the existing world is in shambles. Things have fallen apart so much that you may feel the only sensible thing to do is to try to have a massive leap towards an alternative. Historically, those have all failed. It just has not been the case that the entire systemic reconstruction of a society along alternative principle has succeeded, even though at the time it seemed like there was no alternative. That was the only way you could do it. And I like this. I like to imagine, you know, I'm in Russia, 1918, revolutions occurred, sitting around in the Central Committee of the Russian Communist Party, and people are saying, oh my God, we've got the control of this damn country, what are we going to do? And a sensible person says, look, you know, we've thrown the dice, country's in shambles, we've got two choices. We can pull back and say the best we can hope for is a kind of reformist market economy with some democratic elements. We should pull back towards, they didn't have the notion of Swedish social democracy at the time because it didn't exist, but so to speak, they had an imaginative leap towards a tamed capitalism. And somebody else says, no, I think we should go for it. We should just go for it. Let's smash capitalism, figure out a transition, let's go for it. Let's go for a socialized economy. And people go back and forth arguing as to which, you know, your head spins. How could you possibly make a choice under those conditions? And so one way of thinking about the Russian Revolution is just this momentous historical gamble. But we have those experiments now. China had another gamble. I mean, these were historical experiments in trying to transform systems as a whole rather than the way feudalism became capitalism, which was 200 or 300 years of institution building in the spaces and cracks of capitalism, which then created an alternative which eroded the dominance of feudalism. But, you know, just saying, the viability problem is a really tough one. Nobody should feel confident about it. But we have to grapple with it. You know, just one last thing. If you're really too, you could be too cautious about this too. And that just then, this whole thing collapses into standard public policy incrementalism where all you try to do is patch up and make things a little better on the margins without any vision of transformation. And there's a constant tension between system transformation as an object in itself with huge risks and system preservation through little changes with its incapacity to transform. As I said, Catherine wasn't here, as I said to everyone, I think it's an important thing for academics to tolerate a little bit of silence. You know, it makes academics very nervous when you have a seminar and nobody says anything. We should have a slightly more relaxed attitude. But I will feel comfortable just randomly calling on people. So you should always come prepared to ask a question, even if you don't jump into.
It's not necessarily a question of like the text, but when you were talking about the viable alternatives that you pointed out in the articles that we read, I was just wondering if you see any examples of like those small scale alternatives that you were like laying out, like within maybe even a different community.
Madison is a great place for viable, you know, for real experimentation of all sorts. So, Union Taxi is a worker-owned cooperative. It's one of the few worker-owned taxi companies anywhere. That is, there are things called taxi cooperatives, but they're dispatch cooperatives. They're not the whole company being a cooperative. Isthmus Engineering is a high-end robotic engineering factory that makes industrial robots 100% worker-owned and democratically governed, in which the high-flying engineers and the machinists have one person, one vote. So there's a lot of Madison. Someone told me, I don't know if this is actually true or not, that on a per capita basis, Madison has the highest number of worker-owned firms of any city in the country. You know, who knows, because there's no census of these things. But there's quite a few of them, very successful. That's one kind of area. We are also, and this is documented, the city in which the highest percentage of produce is consumed through community-supported agriculture. And in addition to CSAs, we have community farms in Madison, which are really quite impressive, you know, by the standards of these. What's the one on the north side of Troy Gardens? No, that's a real community farm. It's not just community gardens in the ordinary sense. Those are also experiments in trying to create more participatory and egalitarian forms of alternative. The farmer's market in Madison, farmer's markets are a kind of hybrid sort of thing because these are conventional farmers. But the rules of the farmer's market in Madison are that people can only sell things which they produce. So it's very much interfacing with small farms. It's not surprising that in the big protests of 2 years ago, there was a tractorcade of small farmers which had banners saying farmers for labor. You know, it's not typical for farming communities in the United States. But so those are examples locally of, I think, energetic alternative building. Yeah, Karen.
Yesterday you said you don't like to think of Marxism as a paradigm. Just from my understanding, it sort of sounds like analytical Marxism, as you described it in the readings, is kind of just like using standard sociological method, using like to study Marxist issues through a Marxist paradigm. I'm wondering if that's incorrect.
It's close to correct. When I said the word paradigm is used in social theory discussions to mean a kind of grand framework that ties up everything. It's suggesting a comprehensive theoretical argument. And that's the sense in which I shy away from saying it's a paradigm. Many of you may have read the book The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn. It's a great book. There's lots of criticisms of it. It's a wonderful book, though. And his basic argument is about the nature of scientific paradigms that everybody then buys into in a particular period, and then which get then overthrown by new paradigms. So the Newtonian paradigm gets overthrown by the Einsteinian and quantum mechanical post-Newtonian physics. And that these paradigms, in Kuhn's views, the key thing is that they're incommensurable, that they can't speak to each other. So if you think of paradigms as the kind of intellectual formations that can't speak to each other, they replace each other, that's the sense in which I don't want to treat Marxism as a paradigm. Because I do think it can speak to other traditions of social theory. It can freely borrow and trade. It gets incorporated. Many ideas from Marxism, many mechanisms that Marxists talk about get incorporated in other traditions as well. So I think the softer term tradition is better than paradigm. And it suggests a much more open and eclectic way of thinking about things. Now, within that tradition, there are a core set of ideas and concepts which have proved very resilient, very robust, and which are really the common currency of anyone who is locates their work in that tradition. One could say, okay, that's the paradigmatic core of Marxism, this more restricted notion of these particular concepts, class, exploitation, the capitalist state, capitalism. You know, we'll be exploring that terrain. So I don't have any strong objection to saying, yeah, there still is a kind of paradigm in the center of all of this stuff, but it's a way looser set of notions. And it is not incommensurable, in my view. I don't believe in the incommensurability of different perspectives. Is that? Okay. Let me now start a list. Okay, we got a two-hander, but let me just get my Joe, Catherine, Choyi, Lauren. Okay, so that's my one-handed list, and Tamara.
Just to follow up on what you were saying, like more specifically, what are the methodological and theoretical commitments that you saw that existed in the 60s or whatever, to which analytical Marxism was reacting to? Like, what are you trying to break with, or what happened?
Right. So the simplest, it's a little glib, but I think it still captures the key issue. The simplest thing that we were really struggling against was obscurantism. That is just obscure, vague, elusive concepts that you couldn't nail down. We called the group that formed in the early 80s and is still going on, we called ourselves, I think I might have said this, the NBSMG, the No Bullshit Marxism Group. So we were really combating what we called bullshit. There was even a famous paper written in the 80s called On Bullshit. It was basically trying to give a technical definition of what it means for an academic to be a bullshit artist. That there's a certain preciousness to that discussion. But it was basically when people did a lot of hand-waving and used vague expressions as a way of fending off criticism, as opposed to trying to nail down precisely what are the mechanisms, what would we have to know that these mechanisms were valid? How can they be criticized? How can our knowledge be criticized? Now, that's the general stance. That's very similar in spirit to what's called analytical philosophy, because analytical philosophy is very concerned with precise definitions and logical connections so that everything is clear and transparent and therefore criticizable. That's what we were reacting against. That was a characteristic problem in structuralist Marxism in France, in the critical theory traditions of Germany as well, what's often called Hegelian Marxism. People would invoke the dialectic as if there's some substance to the notion that history unfolds with a thesis, antithesis, and synthesis in some orderly kind of unfolding without specifying what the mechanisms are by which that could be true. So that, I think that's where the analytical and the analytical Marxism comes from. Okay, Joe is next on my list, then Catherine, then Choyi, and then Lauren.
So I'm sort of backtracking. Viable alternatives,
sure.
Thing, and I sort of broke down some of this stuff, but just forgive me if I stumble on my words. So I was thinking about if Madison is sort of like the haven for co-ops in the United States, then what does it really say as co-ops being a viable alternative to capitalism? Because it sort of seems like if this is like the epoch of like co-ops currently in the United States, it doesn't seem like it's a very, it's something that we can think about as like kind of taking over the United States. And secondly, I think about how it's sort of important to talk about the context in which a lot of like the regional co-ops exist, specifically like Mondragon. I think about how it exists within a mountain and they basically have their own army. And they speak their own language. And there are a lot of things that kind of make Mondragon able to kind of exist within capitalism. But I also think about how within Mondragon, like there has been an increase in like wage inequality between managers and workers. And I think about how co-ops in general, if they are to compete on like a larger scale within a capitalist society, face a lot of like huge obstacles.
Right.
So worker owners, for instance, have like their own sort of contradictory kind of existence, because you have to sort of exploit yourself in order to like grow the company or compete with capitalist firms and things like that. And also think about like, even if workers in a co-op democratically decide like not to pollute a lake, then the same capitalist firm that's creating something similar is going to decide, okay, well, we'll pollute the lake, and then we'll basically undercut the co-op,
right.
And then the co-op goes out of business, and then, like, where does that viable alternative, like, go from there?
Okay.
Has to compete.
So, really interesting and thoughtful points. On the first issue, can co-ops plausibly take over the world, you know, given that how limited they are and how special are the historical contexts in which they thrive. The viability argument is not the same as the transformation thesis. So the viability argument is simply asking the question, are these viable institutions? If we could get there, can we stay there? You know, if you could snap your fingers and create an economy in which all firms above a very small size were owned and governed by their work, by their employees. That just as we at one point abolished slavery, we could just simply say, you're not allowed to sign a contract. You can't sign a contract to become a slave. You can't sell yourself to someone in slavery. That's not allowed. We could have a rule that says you cannot sign a contract for employment in which you don't have the power to elect the managers and decide on the basic policies. You know, you have to have democratic form. Just that's what you have to have. So the viability question says, if we could get there, could we stay there? Would that work? Or would it have such pathological problems? You know, there's the too many meetings problem. Everybody would burn out after 4 years, and they would long for the time when somebody else told them what to do. So it's possible. That's the viability question. Now, the transformation question is, we've decided that, yes, this is plausible. There's no real reason why you couldn't have democratic firms being the centerpiece of the economy, and that whatever capitalist firms were left, they have to adjust to the requirements of democratic economy. It's viable. The transformational question is, how do you get from here to there? Now, that means that what you do about Emilia Romagna, the Italian case, or Mondragon, we say, yes, it's historically special reasons why these institutions developed there, but are there things we can learn by the kinds of institutions they built up to protect their co-ops that we could export and adapt in new ways elsewhere? So one of the keys to Mondragon is they have a cooperative bank that helps solve the credit market problem for co-ops. So a big problem that co-ops face is that they're undercapitalized. They have a great difficulty getting credit. Well, Mondragon faced that problem in the late 50s, early 60s, and they came up with a solution. They were able to do so, ironically, because the Basque country was isolated inside of Spain because Franco hated the Basques because they were the hotbed of resistance during the Spanish Civil War. And Spain was isolated in Europe because of fascism. So the Basque country was in this position to be able to improvise and experiment with new forms in a way that would have been much tougher if they were fully integrated. But given that they've discovered this mechanism, it can be copied elsewhere. And then we could ask the question, well, maybe we need new public policies, new state rules about how you form banks so that we can have not just credit unions, but cooperative banks that are oriented towards the cooperative sector. And maybe they should get public subsidies because they're creating a public good. Locally rooted democratic firms is a public good. It's not just good for the people in it. It's good for the community at large to have such firms. So then those become sort of planks on political projects. Whether or not that could ever actually succeed, that's another question. But It does create transition and transformation scenarios that at least have some traction. So that's how to think about the viability and transformation problem. However hard it is to actually accomplish those goals. two-hander, and then Catherine.
I just want to respond to your three questions are basically the three questions that Gar Alperovitz raised when he was visiting last year. And Steve Dubs, who Eric was talking about, works with him, he's the guy coming tomorrow. So if you're interested, those are kind of what Gar gave this brilliant lecture about in co-ops was pinned it all, and he said, but these are, you know, we don't know the answer to these questions. And you've got to get rid of that. So I suggest you go.
One really important thing to keep in mind in this era of great pessimism, which pessimism is easy. You know, optimism takes a little bit of intellectual work to actually find out where's the sources of optimism in the world in which we live. One thing just to remember is how unexpected are the moments of historical optimism and possibility. I'll try to remember to bring to class next Tuesday the text of the Port Huron Statement. I don't know how many of you know what that is. The Port Huron Statement was written 50 years ago, 51 years ago, in 1962. It was the Manifesto of Students for a Democratic Society. It was written in 1962, which should be thought of as the last year of the 50s. Right? The 1960s begin in 62. In 63, you know, with Freedom Summer and those things. The opening pages of the Port Huron Statement sounds like they could have been written yesterday in terms of how dismal things are, how alienated and passive everybody is. You know, just kind of this bleak portrait of what possibilities were. Just on the eve of the 60s when everything exploded. And new possibilities were all over the place. So it's a great, inspiring piece. On the other hand, that it could have been written yesterday is a little discouraging. You know, we're still in the same. Okay. Catherine.
Yeah. So going back to how did the change actually happen? I know in classical Marxism, the idea is that the working class will, kind of make everything change. So in your sort of revised theory of class that you mentioned in one of the readings, you talk about class alliances and class movements. So do you think that would maybe have something to do with this, or who is it? It could still be working class, but who is it that you think would actually make the changes come about?
Right. So this is one of the, whoops, oh, isn't it? This is one of the classic questions. Who are the historical agents? Marxism has a interesting kind of take on that question, which is what we'll be discussing in particular in the very last section when we discuss historical materialism, the theory of history. There's a quip in Marx at one point, which is, history is the judge, the proletariat is the executioner. Which is basically a kind of turn of phrase to suggest that the possibility of transformation is not produced by workers. It's produced by the unfolding of the logic and dynamics of the system. And then workers seize the time. That history gives you the opportunities, but then what class struggle does is seize the time. So the other expression of Marx, class struggle is the motor of history, is actually a little misleading. From its intention with this other formulation, because the motor of history operates behind the backs of actors, whereas class struggle isn't behind the backs, it's actors engaged in conscious struggle over objectives. Well, I'm going to, when we get to that point, criticize some of those ideas. I don't think that's the right way of thinking about the problem. I don't think there is an historical subject in that kind of unifying sense of an actor which is thrown up by history through its natural unfolding of its dynamics that has remotely possible cohesion to act collectively to overthrow a system. And therefore, the transformation of a system shouldn't be thought of as needing an answer to the question, who will transform the system? It's rather, what kinds of collective actors will engage in the sorts of practices that generate in the aggregate, over a long period of time, transformation. And then it's very context dependent. Now, I think workers, people whose lives are bound up with the production of goods and services that in the economic system, in both individually, fragmentedly, and more collectively, will be a key component of any collective project, because the transformation is a transformation of the system of production. And you can't have a transformation of the system of production without having the people who are doing the production being a central part of the transformation. But that doesn't mean that it is class-wide organizations of workers that are the main collective organizations creating these possibilities. You know, sometimes it will be, sometimes it won't be. I don't have a formulaic answer to that problem. And that I'm close to saying it's because there is no possible formulaic answer. This gets into what's called an impossibility theorem, right? So an impossibility theorem is when you actually prove that there could not be something. I can't do that. I'm just skeptical that there could be an answer to the question. Choi Yi.
Oh, that's me. Okay. I'm going to say something bullshit. So I like the idea of alternatives. Okay, so what if I can snap my finger and provide two alternatives? I can move to the moon, or I can be a super intellectual dog, you know? Like, what am I going to do? So I started thinking about that. I mean, it could be possible in the future, right? And I try to think how science could emancipate our thinking. Then I think, okay, let's go back to go back 500 years, where we just didn't know how these kinds of planet works. And I mean, we believe there is heaven and there is earth, right? But later on, we know that the center of the system is not earth. I mean, it could be, at one stage we believe that sun, so, the earth should go around the sun, right? But we still, call that as sunrise, In scientific way, we should call that, earth evolved, something like that, right? So when we have this kind of scientific, development, it really didn't change our perception that much, so that we could call something differently.
Well, so let me just make a comment on that.
Okay.
What science does is it produces cognitive products, mm-hmm. which enable us to understand our perceptions differently. So 500 years ago, sitting on a hillside and watching the sun set, one interpreted the experience of the relative motion of the sun and the earth as also the true relationship between these two bodies. Right, so one, in the pre-scientific understanding, human beings, because we're small little creatures on a big planet looking at a distant star, have the sensory experience of the sun moving to the horizon. And 500 years ago, we thought that was a direct indicator of the relative motion. So we had a cognitive error because of a perception. We no longer have the cognitive error, but we're still small creatures on a big planet with a distant star. So our perception is the same, but it no longer produces a cognitive error. And that's because, in addition to our perception, we also now have knowledge. It's a different process, so that we can feel perfectly happy enjoying the sunset, seeing the sun go, and not say, oh my God, isn't it terrible? We're actually moving. This is horrible. Nobody feels anguish over the fact that our cognitive and our experiential realities at that moment are in conflict, because they're not in conflict. Our theories help us explain both why we perceive it that way and what the true relationship is. Right? So the
So you think, you know, science could be a game changer sometimes, you know, at least at the awareness level, right?
It can, if, right, so it can certainly be a game changer sometimes. In social science, the problem is that the kind of knowledge products that science produces are constantly competing with other kinds of cognitive processes, products that are being produced by ideology. So there's this constant battle in people's understanding between these different cognitive products, as it were.
So it could be something like constantly unchanged. For instance, like you try to, you know, make someone happy, you send her or him flowers. Well, flowers could be a sex organ of a plant, which doesn't really make sense to show your love, but you still send it.
Or it could make a lot of sense, depending upon the message.
I just think that, you know,
So in the Marxist tradition, there is a concept that's been used a lot and which makes lots of people very nervous, which is the notion of false consciousness. Right? We'll be discussing false consciousness and how to think about that idea. It often confuses two quite distinct problems. One is people simply having false beliefs about the world. And people surely do have false beliefs about the world. And those false beliefs are correctable through evidence and argument sometimes. Sometimes they're not correctable because a person has such emotional stake in their false beliefs that they refuse to interrogate them. So I have a neighbor who's a fundamentalist Christian and who doesn't believe in evolutionary biology. And no amount of evidence and argument that I can offer is going to shake that belief, because the belief is self-validating given other commitments that that person has, such as arguments against creationism or arguments of the devil, right? So it's pretty hard if you're discredited off the ground to be able to argue. So I think false consciousness is a perfectly reasonable concept so long as it's referring to false beliefs that people hold. When it's referring to other aspects of people's subjectivity, such as their identities, then I think it's an illegitimate concept. I don't think, for example, if a person feels that their identity as an indigenous person is more salient in their lives and sort of more deeply defines who they are than their identity as a in terms of class, that's not a false consciousness. That's no such thing as they're not making a mistake. They may be harming their ability to struggle for material gain, it's possible, but that may not be as important as their defense of their cultural traditions. And I don't think it's a correct way of talking about that to say that's false. You can talk about it by saying, look, here are the implications of deciding that your solidarity with other people of your culture is more important than your solidarity of other people of your class. Here are the implications for your life of making that choice. And they may have incorrect beliefs about the implications. So they may have false beliefs in that sense. But I don't think it makes sense to say their identities are false. I don't think that's the right way to think about that problem. We'll get to this again. This is in the ideology section under the rubric mystification. Talk about false consciousness. I have no qualms about false consciousness as a concept, so long as it has this highly cognitive component. And it's at one with my commitment to science. Marxists, of course, used it in a way more potent and dangerous way, in which they really would talk about people having false identities, not just false beliefs about how the world works. I think we have time for... Lauren was the last person on the list, so get through our one-handed list.
Yeah, I was curious about reflexivity. Came when we were talking about emancipatory social science. And, you know, you hear a lot of folks emphasize the importance of reflexivity, but it's been curious about how that actually affects research, you know, so could you think of an example where a more reflective social science, reflexive social science, actually reaches like different conclusions than a less reflexive social science, or is it just, or is it a matter of choice of research questions and things like that?
So the notion of a reflexive social science, it actually has, there's two dimensions to it. One is understanding how one's own positionality affects one's own observations. So if you're doing an ethnography and you're unreflexive, you just assume that you're an observer who can observe because you're smart and you've got good eyesight and good ears. And the fact that you're a white male North American in an indigenous village in Mexico is, it's only interesting. But your positionality doesn't affect your what you can perceive. That would be a completely numbskull, non-reflexive ethnographer. So ethnography has always argued for reflexivity. The necessity of knowing how your own position with respect to the things you're, the people you're observing, not only affects your perceptions, but how it affects the kind of relationship you establish with those people, which will affect the kind of information you can observe. Participant observation as a form of ethnography is insistent upon the importance of being immersed in a context where you are living and doing with other people. Michael Burrowboy's, you know, worked for years in factories, not under the illusion that that would render him indistinguishable from his workmates, but it would be the necessary condition for him to understand his own positionality with respect to it. Now that's very highly reflexive stuff. And in the ethnographic case, if you're really non-reflexive, you do crappy work and doesn't people recognize it. The question is just how deeply do you worry about it? The other kind of reflexivity is the reflexivity of the results of your work. That is, you are seeing your work as part of the world that you're studying. I can't think off the top of my head of an example of research that treats that as its own object, rather than it being part of the motive, as you suggested, it's part of the motivation for why you're doing the work, knowing that it's going to be part of the world in which you are studying. You know, it's an interesting thing for, as you read various things to think about, is the extent to which that self-understanding of the research, how it shapes the nature of the research itself. I'll think about it, see if I have anything more to say about it on Tuesday. And it's 12:02, and in the spirit of punctual starts and punctual ends, let's close up for today.